Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, and many thanks to Damon Kitney, who's found time to speak for us in this busy period in the lead up to the festive season break. Now, he'll be well known to many of you. He's the Victorian business editor of The Australian, but he's been around journalism for many years, but in the last decade, based in Melbourne as the Victorian business editor for The Australian, and he's written lots of stories on business and related topics. But he's here tonight on the occasion of the publication of The Price of Fortune, The Untold Story of Being James Packer, biography, which has received notice since it was published very recently. And so the topic for tonight's talk is just that, James Packer and his world. Damon Kitney, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, for that kind introduction, and thank you all of you for coming along tonight to listen to me sort of take you through, I guess, the war story, if that's the right way of putting it. Of putting this book together, because it was a bit of a saga, if that's the right term. I think at the end of the day, I think we've landed in a good spot, but it has been a very stressful period. And I guess at the outset, I do give my great thanks to Mr. Packer himself for the time that he put into this project, and for the honesty that you will read in this book. It is incredibly raw, and it's to his great credit that he was willing to take that risk, if I can put it that way, to be so honest. And I would actually challenge many business people and certainly politicians to show the level of honesty that he has in this book. It really is a rarity. I first met James in the second half of 2002, and this was a year after the collapse of OneTel, which you would all remember. The company then was called Publishing and Broadcasting that he ran, and a guy called Peter Yates was the CEO at the time. He actually introduced me to James over lunch in Kerry Packer's famed fifth floor dining room. Now, if you've been down to the Park Street offices of PBL, as they were known, you took the lift from the third floor, which was the executive floor, up to the fifth floor for lunch. And when you sat there, you had these wonderful lace tablecloths. You had the Packer family cutlery. And I remember one time when I went to James and went there for lunch with James, Kerry was still alive. So he had a bit of a look of trepidation on his face. And when we got in the lift to go between the third and the fifth floor, he actually said to me, "If Dad gets in the lift today, you're not an effing journalist, okay?" So that was an interesting introduction. I do remember, though, James was very courteous. He was respectful. But you always sensed there was a short fuse lurking beneath. And I remember I was actually working for Fairfax at the time for the Financial Review. And when you raised the subject of my employer, he was not short of a vocal opinion or an expletive. I never actually met Kerry Packer. He never got in the lift that day, and I never actually got introduced to him. I had to chase him with a tape recorder after a PBL AGM or two up the corridor, where he said nothing except smiled. It's a one regret, I guess, in doing this project. If I had have actually met Kerry, I think I would have even better understood about his son. because their relationship, and you'll read in the book, is a very powerful backdrop to James's life. In fact, it's more than a backdrop. It's a very powerful factor in so many parts of his life. It hasn't all been rosy for me and James. Yes, I've known him for 20 years, but during the global financial crisis, I certainly became persona non grata in his world. I wrote several articles in the AFR at the time that he didn't like. I wasn't alone. There was plenty that wrote bad things about him during that period, because he made some bad calls. He made some bad investments. The company lost more than $1 billion. I remember after all that happened, I reached out to him to catch up. We used to catch up a couple of times a year, always off the record, very casual. When I sent him one email, I got a response which said, "Why would I bother?" That was James. He was always good for a cutting email. I pulled myself back from the brink in September 2010. I actually went to Macau. You'll remember he had a casino resort there, and I went to see a show up there which was opening. And to be honest, one of the prime reasons I went was not for the story, but it was actually to see James, look him in the eye and say, "I'm still here. I haven't gone anywhere." And we actually bumped into each other at a reception for the event. And there was only small talk, but the most important thing was it broke the ice. Also, by then, I'd moved to The Australian, which I think also earned me a chance at redemption, working for News Corp instead of Fairfax. I will be clear, we've always maintained a cordial, professional relationship. Until this book happened, I'd never been on a plane or a boat. And even in this book, I still haven't been on a plane with James Packer. I spent 2 days on a boat where I interviewed two people. But that was my first time I actually got inside his world. I'd also never been to one of his houses, other than one quick dinner I had at Bondi when I was working for the Fin Review for a profile I was doing on James. So to be able to see his world, I saw him for this book in Argentina, in Aspen, in Mexico, and in Los Angeles. And I got to see him in all his different worlds. You'll note none of those were in Australia. So for this book, you had to go to him. He certainly was not coming to me. I should be clear from the start, James never actually wanted this book to happen. I know you might find that strange given the level of honesty that's in it. When I visited him in Argentina in October last year for an article for the Weekend Australian magazine, which some of you have hopefully read, I asked him that day, "Would you ever tell your extraordinary tale in a book?" He looked at me and smiled before he said, "No way." But as I walked out of the room, he added, "If I ever do a book, Damon, I will do it with you." Now, I thought that would never happen, so I didn't take much from that. But it was quite a telling comment, and it worked to my advantage, because when I got back to Australia, after that magazine article appeared, I was actually approached by a publisher completely out of the blue. I had no intention of writing a book. And the publisher said to me, "We've read that piece from Argentina. We really like it. You seem to have an affinity with James to get him to talk honestly. We'd like you to write his biography." I gave him the response that he gave to me in Argentina. I said, "No chance." They said, "Well, can you try again?" And I still remember the day I got the phone call from one of his advisors after I'd had the request in for a couple of weeks. I picked up the phone and he said to me, "I believe I'm talking to James Packer's biographer." I could not believe it. And I would say a minute later, I received an email from James where he said to me, "Looking forward to the journey together." It was really a dream come true, if you can call it a dream, because as I said, I never thought this would happen. The thing about James is, though, once he resolved in his mind he was going to assist with this book, he threw himself into the project. We did countless hours of face-to-face interviews on three continents. I went and saw him in Aspen in January. We did 16 hours of interviews over 4 days. It was an incredibly grueling experience for me, but especially for him. As I mentioned earlier, our final meeting was on his super yacht in France, where I met his spiritual guru, a guy called Tom Knowles, who you'll read about in the book. Just by chance, a guy turned up on that boat called Aki Busson, who you may have heard of. He's the ex-husband of Elle Macpherson and Uma Thurman, and he ended up doing an interview for the book as well. James and I exchanged hundreds of emails and texts over the research time for this book. James is a voracious emailer. I don't know if many of you know that, but some days I would wake up and there would be 20, but some days 50 emails from him that have come overnight. Some of them would be a quote, some of them would be a document, some would be a photograph. Some would just be, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, a long rant about something that was on his mind. But to me, it was such an incredible thing to be able to get all that information from him in this real outpouring, because it told me so much about him and the troubles that he'd been through in his world. He told me on several occasions how much the project was taking out of him physically and emotionally. And you would all know the manifestation of that became shockingly apparent on the 20th of March this year when he resigned from the Crown Board, citing mental health reasons. 5 days earlier, James had spent his first night in Los Angeles since October 2016. He'd lunched that day with Warren Beatty, the guy, as you may have seen in some of the extracts of the book, he called Dad. He stayed at the Peninsula Hotel that night after visiting his children and their mother, Erica. It was really exciting for him, but it was also incredibly stressful. The memories of Hollywood and Los Angeles were still fresh in his mind. And, of course, one thing I haven't mentioned yet, the romance with a certain diva called Mariah Carey. James was also stressed at the time about the Easter travel plans of Erica and the children. He had grown to fear Australia, and the fact that they were coming back here for Easter was something that played on his mind. I know that's incredible to conceive, but that is the reality. I had a clue that something was amiss with James in a series of emails that we exchanged in the day before that public announcement. In one, he told me, quote, "I've had very little sleep these last few days and am feeling unwell." A couple of other emails that came to me during that period, to be frank, scared me. And they actually made me wonder whether I would still have a book. One particularly scary one I replied to was met with an instant reply from him. It took 10 seconds. And he just said to me, "Damon, I need a break. James." The next day, 2 days later rather, he resigned from the Crown Board. For 2.5 weeks, he didn't reply to any of my messages. It's public that he was treated in Boston at a mental health clinic. I've got to say they were two of the most stressful weeks of my life because I did not know whether I had a book. At the start of March, I actually hadn't written a word on paper for this book. So I resolved in my mind the best thing I could do with a deadline of July was just to get on with it. So I buried myself in writing. Everything changed at 10:20 p.m. on April 9, and I was sitting on my iPad, just at home. I got an email from James. He told me that he was back at what he called Peaceful Elestina, which is his polo ranch in Argentina. And he explained to me what had happened, and I'll just read you what he'd said to me. "I've been sober during 2018, and in March this year, I was experiencing major panic attacks and felt extremely depressed and paranoid. It was scary, very scary, especially as I was sober and I thought I'd been improving. It was very hard to come to any other conclusion than my problems and condition were not getting better. It felt like they were getting worse. I was desperately worried, and that's why I got off the Crown Board and why I said what I said publicly. I feel fine now. There are a lot of moments where I regret getting off the Crown board because I think I'm fine. The most important line in this email was the final one. And he said to me, I recommit to this project 100%, Damon. I'm going to see it through. And he vowed to be as transparent and honest with me as possible. I can tell you that night, my wife had been asleep for an hour. I rushed in and woke her up and showed her the email because it was a huge breakthrough and a huge relief. You might find this hard to believe, but at the outset, James said he didn't want to read the manuscript before it was published. Nor did he want to know the title of the book. And he kept his word right through the process. I remember one evening I was sitting typing away and a text bobbed up. And all it said was, I know your title, dot, dot, dot. There was nothing that followed for another minute. And that was another scary minute. Thankfully, a smiley face followed. He did like the title. It did surprise me. But he thought it summed up our experience in doing the book. One problem with James not reading the book is a number of extracts, as you know, were published in my paper and others. James read every word of them. He found them very confronting, in particular the first one that appeared in the Weekend Australian, which had the photo of him and Warren Beatty on the cover. One person who was with him in Argentina the day that story was published said to me that James was, quote, unquote, shattered. I reached out to James on the Sunday after that was published, and I just said to him, I hope you're okay. And he said to me, I'm not feeling good. Reading your chapter didn't help. This is one of the challenges of this whole process. Other revelations that came out in the 2 weeks, 3 weeks that followed, they did upset him. But on a positive note, I'd know he received countless messages of support from people that really mattered to him. And he told me that a couple of times, which helped balance things out. In particular, I've had people come to me over the past month who haven't spoken to him in ages, and they've asked for his details because they wanted to reach out to him. That meant a lot. I can report, thankfully, the storm now appears to have passed. James has even asked me, unprompted, how the sales of the book have been going. What I've tried to do in this book is tell the human story of being James Packer, the son of one of the toughest and most famous fathers of them all, the brother of Gretel, the lover of celebrities, the husband of Jodie and Erica, and the father of Indigo, Jackson and Emmanuel, and the businessman who almost lost it all yet managed to survive, but at a cost reflected in his addictions, broken marriages, lost friendships, and his eventual admission that despite his vast wealth and fortune, he needed help. I'd like to thank the more than 60 people who've contributed to this book, and that included his two ex-wives, believe it or not. It included his sister and even her advisor. James' first wife, Jodie Mears, who you'll find had some amazing contributions to this book. She even came to the launch event in Sydney that we had on October 22, which I thought was pretty classy. And it showed you the depth of feeling between them. The honesty of the stories, the insights, the colour from all these people really helped give the book so many different dimensions. And in particular, the relationship between James and his father, you will read the comments of a number of people in the book. People like Alan Jones, Peter Barron, Graham Richardson, people who saw that relationship up close, John Alexander. They all talk, I would argue, in the most open way you've ever seen about the relationship between James and Kerry. But I'd like to just end my speech before I take questions with where I started. Most of all, I do want to say thanks to James for having the guts to do this, because I know it's been a painful experience for him. He trusted me to be fair and accurate for good and bad, and that is what I believe I have been. He's actually told me several times that he will never read this book. One day, I truly hope he does, because for all the pain in its pages, I believe this book will help him. And I actually hope that his children read it one day too. But time will tell. Thank you.
Thanks, Damon. And as I said, we've got copies of The Price of Fortune, the untold story of being James Packer. And so we come to questions and discussion. Just starting off, in one of those emails he sent to you, he said, "Why would I bother?" But eventually, later on, he did bother. Why do you think that he decided to do it? Was it cathartic? Did he feel a need to talk to someone, and you were the best person to talk to, or did you convince him that he should do it? Why do you think he did it? Because he took a big risk, particularly sure. Since he's got mental health problems. It's a big risk, isn't it?
Look, I think for him there was so much of a void in the public discourse about his life. Obviously, his life has been covered to an inch of its life in the media over so many decades. That has certainly pained him. He uses this amazing comment in the book when he talks about this country, the country of his birth. He says, "I'm scared of Australia. I'm scared of Sydney. I'm scared of its judgment, and I'm scared of its media." It's an incredible comment for someone of his stature. But then he goes on to say, when I'm in Argentina, when I was in Israel, when I'm in LA, I'm anonymous. I'm just another person. And he has really used that escape. So in that context, there has been a great void about what's been going on in his life for all these years. And I think he had this need inside to tell the world, to give them some context to what they've seen publicly, to explain, I guess, a bit of the myth, if that's the right term. And there has been a great myth out there about James's life during this period. He knew it was going to be difficult, no doubt about that. And it was difficult. But I think you're right. It was a cathartic experience for him. I think I've been very lucky in my life as a professional journalist with James that I've never wanted anything from him except a story. And I think I was very lucky that he's always found me someone who he has a professional relationship with, who he trusts, who he feels he can talk to. People have joked, you know, that I felt, did I feel like a psychiatrist in this situation? I didn't think about it that way at all. What I wanted to do, and I told him the first time we sat down in Aspen in January, and I write this in the book, he said to me, "What do you really want to achieve here?" And I said, "It's very simple. I want to tell the human story of being James Packer. Warts and all, fair and accurate. Simple as that." And he looked at me with a cigarette in hand and said, "All right, I'm up for that." And off we went.
Thank you. There's a question here.
I understand today, this week, he's cancelled attending a function to be with his mother on her 80th birthday. Have you any... did you see his mother? Can you just comment on the relationship between James and his mother? Thank you.
Yeah, and I should say I haven't corresponded with anybody about that. I haven't spoken to him about it. I think James is very close to his mother. In fact, he says in the book that he feels he's more like his mother than his father, and there are others that say that as well. And I think that's true. James does have a softer side to his character. That it's debatable. People that know or knew Kerry would say Kerry had the same, but James has a different softness to him than Kerry had. And I think that's one of the things, to be honest, people look at James's relationships with women over so long. It's part of the reason that endears him to women, he does have that soft side of his character. And you can see what J.D. Mears says about him in the book and what Erica says about him, that Yeah, he does have a side that not many people know. It's one of the regrets, I guess, for me of the book process and the way it unfolded that I didn't get to speak to his mother. We had one email exchange and she was quite prepared to talk to me, which was really exciting and wonderful. And unfortunately, that event of March 20 intervened. And you may remember, unfortunately, Roz was chased around Sydney Airport by a photographer when she went off to visit her son in Boston. And that really traumatised her, understandably. So I thought, out of respect to her, that the best thing to do would just be to leave her alone, and that's what I did. But I would love to have interviewed her for the book. I think it would have really added another perspective.
If he'd come out of the March 20 treatment and had not corresponded with you or refused, would you have continued with the book? Would you have had enough to work with?
I'm glad I didn't have to answer that question. Very, very difficult question to answer, to be honest. The challenge was that this is not James's book. This was a publisher's book. And I guess that would have been an issue I'd have to deal with the publisher. My human instinct would be that you would not proceed with it because this is stuff that he'd provided to me on great trust. And to go ahead without his consent would be a total breach of that trust. My publisher may have had a different idea. Thankfully, I didn't have to deal with that. But, yeah, it was one of the great issues that I was wrestling with over that three-week period was, what do I do if this doesn't go any further?
David, you interviewed a lot of different people, and he's got a global reference point and an Australian one. Can you tell us about some of those people and how they saw him? Who were the people that gave you great, you know, really good insights? And presumably there'd be those who give you insights about his family and his Australian background, but then there'd be others who give you a much broader perspective of the adult James.
Mm. Well, I think
one of the best ones there.
Well, it's pretty hard to go past a Hollywood movie legend to start with in Warren Beatty. And to James's great credit, he facilitated that interview because there's no way it would have happened otherwise. But he said to me early on in the process, actually, Warren's name came up in our January discussion, particularly if you've read the first extract of the book, that terrible time that James went through in 2016 when he was drinking more than a bottle of vodka a day, and Warren was taking him to see psychiatrists because he was staying at Warren's guest house in Bel Air. But I think, yeah, for James it was, he says, he called Warren Dad, which is quite amazing. It's funny, when I sat down with Warren, he was quite cautious for, and I say this in the acknowledgements in the book, he's very cautious for about the first 40 minutes. He warned me when we sat down that I'm not a good interviewer because he doesn't do interviews. And we were sort of going around in circles a bit, and I could see that he was not quite sure where I was coming from, whether I was out to get James or whether I was trying to help him or what. He was trying to suss me out. But to his great credit, I think once he realised in his mind that he could trust me, he actually opened up quite a bit about what he saw in James. And he has a huge admiration for him. It's quite fascinating, really. And the amazing thing that happened there is after we came to the end of our interview, James was actually having lunch with Warren at the Beverly Hills Hotel in the famed Polo Lounge there. And Warren said to me at the end of the interview, like, what are you doing now? And I said, oh, well, I'm just waiting around till you guys have lunch and then I'm going to say hi to James before he flies off. And he said, well, why don't you come down? I was like, you sure? He said, yeah. He said, why don't you give us 40 minutes on our own and then come and join us? Which, I mean, we were there for another hour and a half. Fascinating to just see these guys talking. And they talked about, you know, lots of different things, about lots of different things in the world. But you could just see the affection between them. So that was sort of my only time with Warren. I would like to have had more, but it didn't work out. Other people offshore that I saw, Lawrence Ho, his Chinese sort of gaming partner, gave me a good 2 hours of his time in Hong Kong. I had never met Lawrence properly. I'd said hi at a function or two. He was absolutely amazing to give his insights into their time together. And you could see there's been a lot of speculation about what happened in Macau when James' staff got arrested and whether, you know, Lawrence had anything to do with it. But you could see in his eyes, like, he genuinely missed his friendship with James because they'd lost touch. They didn't have a falling out, they just lost touch. And I thought Lawrence really enjoyed the opportunity to relive so much of that time through our discussion. You could see it in his eyes, like, he was genuinely excited to talk about the good times with James. But one of the most amazing things Lawrence said was that when he saw James come out with his mental health issues publicly, he didn't even know. And he said, I really felt bad that a brother, as he called him, was suffering so badly and I never knew it. James hit it very well. So that was great. And then I thought, I've already mentioned in my speech, meeting Jodie Mears, and she just met me down at Watson's Bay on a sunny morning on a park bench. When we were trying to arrange a meeting, she said, do you mind if we just meet in my favourite park? And I said, sure. And when I turned up, she was in bare feet, just a summer dress, kicking a half-eaten basketball around with a dog that was probably bigger than her. And we just sat on the park bench. She just lit up a cigarette and off we went. She actually said to me at the start, I don't really know how this works. I said, well, I'll just throw a tape on and we can talk. And she was just so insightful on so many levels about his life. Unfortunately, James' second wife, Erica, fell into the same category as his mother. She was all ready to talk to me face-to-face. We had a meeting set up, and then March 20 happened, and she felt it was not appropriate. In light of that, to meet me, and she obviously doesn't live in Australia, so that was my chance to see her face-to-face. To her great credit, then we corresponded over email at least, and I was able to get her thoughts into the book, which, again, were incredibly generous and very open about why they still stay together. But one of the guys that surprised me most, to be honest, and I'm, well, two guys actually, that I'm really indebted to. The first one's Kerry Stokes, and you would have seen some of the media coverage around what he had to say. None of that I knew. None of it. This stuff about stopping weddings, moving boats, taking over James's company. No one knew any of it until Kerry very graciously talked about that time. And he did it not to grandstand. He did it because of his affection for James and to try to explain, give the world some explanation of what was going on in that period. I mean, it was just a really bizarre, frightening time. And it just says something about Kerry, I think. The other one was Alan Jones. Whatever you think of Alan, he gave me an hour of his time down here at the Toaster. We looked out over the Harbour Bridge. And he went into areas that no one has ever talked about the Packer family, particularly about James's younger days and the difficulties that he had sort of growing up. Like, it was really, really raw stuff. And not once did Alan come back to me afterwards and say, oh, I didn't mean to say this or that or whatever. I just thought it was to his great credit. In fact, I ran into him in the studios of 3RW in Melbourne just a couple of weeks ago. I did my interview with Neil Mitchell on air, and Neil said to me as I was walking out, he said, oh, you should go say hi to your mate. I said, oh, Alan Jones is just in the studio next door. And so I waited around for half an hour, and he came out, and he was just so generous. He said, how's it all going? Hope it's going really well. Yeah, I've got to give him great credit for that. But I can go on with the list. I think one of the most fascinating guys I met, again, from the Hollywood scene, was a bloke called Brett Ratner, who you would have read about, and he was James's Hollywood film partner. And he kindly gave me a good couple of hours of his time. I went along to the house that he has in Beverly Hills. It's a very, very famous house. In fact, as we sat down, I looked over his right shoulder, and I don't know if it was strategic or not, but there was a photo of Mariah Carey sitting on the floor. Now, he's obviously, you know, done a lot of stuff with her. But, yeah, I felt that she was peering over his shoulder all the time as we were talking. And to be fair to Brett, he just shot from the hip. He was very open. Any question I asked, he was happy to answer. People have been critical of Brett, and I put those criticisms to him, and he answered them. So it was very kind of him to give me that time. So, yeah, I could go on with the longer list, but you'll have to read the book.
Thank you, Pierre.
I'm just wondering, knowing what you know about his past, etc., what do you think the future has in store for Robin James and the wider Packer family?
It's a question about his future and the wider Packer family.
It's a very hard question to answer at the moment. Everything's still pretty raw. What I do know is that James is in a much better place mentally than he's been for a while. He's quite comfortable. I think one of the challenges, and he says this himself in the book, I'm not giving away any secrets, he is on a heavy prescription medication regime to deal with his condition. He puts it with quite cutting quotes. One is that I feel I'm on the US pharmaceutical treadmill. Secondly, he says I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. Which is quite sad, really. But he's just... The thing about James is he's incredibly honest, almost to the point of self-deprecation. But I certainly feel that he can come back, and I write that in the book. A lot of that will depend on how he deals with that condition. I think the most important thing in James's life over the next few years is one thing only, and it's what's down there coming out of the ground. He is really going to take it very quiet and easy, I think, for the next couple of years until that project comes to fruition, because it is his ultimate dream, I guess, to be able to have a project in his own city of his birth. And I think he's hoping, and he says this too, that it will be his chance to return to Australia with something that he can be proud of. Now, you know, you can take it or leave it about gambling and whatever, and that's a different issue. But for him, that project is like a deeply personal thing. It was something his father was never able to do in the city. He looked at it a few times, and it didn't happen. So, yeah, I think you'll find James will be very quiet for the time being until that project. But one thing I'll say, though, and James knows this better than anybody, things change very quickly in his life. You know, and you used the example earlier. He was off to this wedding and then he decided he wasn't. That's just what happens. He changes his mind.
Just before we move to the next question, just give us a bit of a background on the project. Some people know about it, some don't. So the project down at Barangaroo.
Oh, sorry, yeah. This is just the Crown Sydney Casino Resort development. It's due to open in 2021. You know, it's a $2 billion project. But the most important thing about it is the personal aspect for James is he really put himself out in the public domain in a way like he'd never done before to get that project approved. And there's been a lot written about the process and whether it was done properly or not. That's another issue. But for James, it was a deeply personal project. And he actually says in the book, for the first time, the personal toll it took on him. When Barry O'Farrell and David Murray, who was doing a report for the government on the project, announced that Crown was getting the green light because they were up against their adversaries over the other side there in Pyrmont, called the Star, James was actually in Bora Bora on his boat when that happened, and he got the call through, and it was this moment of absolute glee, but it was very, very short-lived because at the same time his second marriage was about to break up. And he says that through that campaign for Sydney, he was on a diet of cigarettes, vodka, lime and soda, prescription testosterone and not much else. And you can remember, he looked $1 million during that period, as he called it. He had his six-pack then. but it took an amazing toll on him through that period. And now it's fact that his marriage broke up around that time.
Was there anyone who was like who you thought might have been really important to speak to who actually rejected an interview?
One very important one. His name is David Gingell, which is, I mean, that's probably one of the sad stories of the book, I guess. But you know, I don't want to pass judgment. But James is very critical of David in the book. And I went to David to seek his comment, but he didn't want to buy into it. I tried to present his side of the story as best I could from what he had said publicly before, but that was probably the big no out of the book. I can say I did try to speak to Kevin Rudd, and he didn't want to speak to me. Not that that really matters, to be honest, because he didn't play a big role. But and that's not dismissing it. I'm just saying that you know, Kevin wasn't a huge player, but I would just like to have talked to him about James. There's a chapter in the book about James and politics, and that's why I wanted to talk to Kevin, because James did do a lot of face-to-face work in Canberra around Foxtel and those regulatory issues. But, you know, that's fine. That's his prerogative. So.
There's a question there. Yeah.
Thanks, Damon. That's a great story. This experience of writing the book, how has that changed you as a journalist and as a human being?
Now, the first question is still to be answered, I think, because I'm still trying to return to normal life a bit from this. So it's a bit hard to give a response. I mean, I am very lucky in my job, and have been for a number of years now, that one of my niches in journalism is to write, excuse the term, the human stories of rich private people. And I think the number of private people that I've been able to speak to over the last 10 years has helped me in this process, because it's sometimes been deeply emotional issues that we've dealt with, particularly where it's involved business people that have had illnesses. So that was probably a good sort of trial run for this. And I guess as I do more of those interviews in the future, which I will continue to do, I would hope this process even enhances that. And it's back to the question you sort of asked before. It's sort of knowing how to manage difficult moments. I mean, there were times in our discussions where James, you know, was deeply unhappy. He got angry at one stage about a particular topic, and it wasn't pleasant. But you know, we rode through it, and to his great credit, it took him like 2 minutes before he was like, "Yep, all good. Let's keep going." As a person, again, time will tell. I mean, I guess it's still all a bit of a blur at the moment. You know, but I do, as I said, where we started tonight, you know, I have a huge respect for what he's done. You can, you know, think whatever you like about him, but I think this just deserves, you know, massive admiration for having the guts to put yourself out there in this way. Yeah, I mean, I just can't speak more highly of that.
I can't get a mic. Okay, here. You got it? Yeah.
Caught in the middle.
Could you say a couple of sentences about James and Mariah Carey?
Only a couple?
Good.
There's a book in that in itself.
I've read your Australian article, but I haven't read your book.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. Look, I think one thing about that, you can, everybody dismisses it as a folly and whatever, and that's fine. But James, I think, genuinely liked Mariah's company. I know some people find that hard to believe, but he made this great comment in the book, like, you'd think James Packer could get the best table anywhere, the best hotel room, whatever, but he said, when I was with Mariah, I was at the top table everywhere because of her, not me. So it was like this power couple, really. And that's the thing about James. You remember, he's an Australian businessman. He was not well known and still isn't well known on the global stage. That elevated him into this amazing, global picture. Now, you know, maybe not necessarily for the right reasons, I know, you know, I have a Google alert on my phone about James and Packer, as I do with all the people that I follow, and it was just going like mad through that period. Every day you'd wake up, there'd be another 50 stories about something that had happened on some gossip celebrity site. But, you know, he did actually really enjoy her company, I think, and she has said publicly in the good times that they really, you know, they had a good time together. It wasn't just a complete folly. But I think if James was looking at it now, and he does say this in the book, you know, he was just in a really bad place, and so was she. They were both, you know, just really, really in bad spots in their lives, and they came together. And unfortunately, sometimes, you know, that's happened to a lot of people in the world, where they perhaps get together at the worst possible time for them.
Did you interview Mariah?
No, I didn't try, to be honest, and that's out of no, you know, there's no agenda to that. I just thought, in the time frame that I had, and I guess it comes back to the fact that, you know, James generously introduced me to a lot of people, but he told me from the start that he said, "I can't help you with Mariah," and that's fine. That's his prerogative. So I just I didn't really see how much it was going to add. I mean, look, it could have been an amazing thing if she actually did open up, but I just had to. That's when you're doing something as quick as this, is a pretty fast time frame. I had to basically try to get to what I thought was doable. There wasn't really much time to hang around waiting for months for people to come through. And again, to James's great credit, the people that he introduced me to, it was like lightning how fast they came back and said, "When do you want to do it?" It was like this license for all of them to tell their stories. And his message to every single person he would open the lines up for me with, he said, "This is not my book, it's Damon's book. I'm not going to read it, either before or after it's published." And he said, "I want you to tell your truths about me, good and bad." And I think those words just gave this great license to a lot of people for the first time to really tell their true stories about him. And I mentioned a couple of individuals before who've never talked in that way about him. So,
question here.
G'day.
It is just so fascinating with these rich people, you know, their lives are lived large. But do you ever just feel like saying to him, "Mate, are you addicted to drama? Could you have just had a bit of a quieter life?" Did he have much sort of real, genuine self-reflection around how much he was creating, you know, these problems for himself?
I think it's just a product of the way James lived his life for so many years. It's very fast-paced. That's why now it's just such a stark contrast. But, you know, when James was good, like, and you can talk to anybody who dealt with him, like, you couldn't get a more charming businessman who ran at a million miles an hour. And I've seen James in those times, and it's quite incredible how fast paced he lives things. So I think he sort of got swept up in all that, and he found it very difficult to stop. I think through his life, it's public, you know, he's always had that time in the Mediterranean in June and July, and he's done it for years now, and I think he does take that time to sort of de-stress. But at the same time, I mean, when he does that, there's still people coming and going from the boat week in, week out, celebrities getting chased around Bora Bora, like, you know, some have done in recent times, and I can't see how that's not stressful. Yeah, so anyway, it is that world that they live in. It's very hard to sort of imagine it if you're not in it.
Question down there.
Do you think that even though Kerry died a long time ago, that James is still driven by the influence that Kerry had on him and living in his shadow?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It's interesting, in the book, James is not critical of his father at all. In fact, he eulogises him, which is, it's quite sweet in some ways, but I think he's always carried that burden, I guess, of living up to the giant that his father was. And another person I haven't mentioned so far, David Gonski, is quoted in the book, and David never talks about the Packer family. That's his public policy. But he made an exception for me, which was very kind. And he says if James had not inherited the wealth that he had, he would have been an even better businessman on the global stage, because he wouldn't have carried that legacy to have to always maintain and build the fortune. He could have actually been much more, I don't know, free-spirited, to not have that burden sitting on his shoulder. I think James has found that very hard throughout his life. And then the other aspect of that is how his father treated him, which again is up for debate depending on who you talk to, but I think you'll find in the book some of the reflections of some of those individuals I mentioned earlier are very open about some of the bad times between them and the impact that they had on him mentally. And it's just, you'll never know, but I certainly know that it certainly played a factor.
We're getting close to the end. There's a question here.
But I'll hog the ball. Does he see a fourth generation Packer coming through? Does he nurture one of the children?
That's a really hard one, because they're so young. He does mention in one quote on one page that he would like to see his children go into the business one day, but it's just too early to make that judgment. And look, he was kind enough to introduce me to the children, and you know, they're great kids. And in fact, when I saw them in Mexico, and sadly they had to leave, and we had to get to work, and I reckon it was within 20 minutes of them heading off that his eldest daughter was FaceTiming him in the middle of our discussion, and he had to sort of say, "I'm really sorry, darling, but I've got work to do." But that, I thought that was quite, it's very hard to script that, like that's real life. He may have all this money and all these wonderful worldly possessions, but his children are still incredibly important to him, which I think is pretty cool. And Erica makes the point in the book, in her comments, just about how their relationship is so important for the sake of the children. And that's another reason why she lives in Los Angeles, because she wants the children to grow up with anonymity, away from the glare of the public eye that you get here.
Question up there.
Damon, we've got the three big communication giant families, the Fairfaxes, the Murdochs, the Packers. And it's interesting how the generations have been so different. And in the Packer family, where does Gretel sit? Because in this generation of powerful women and women who are, you know, take Murdoch's daughter, she's always had a slice of the pie. Why is there something in this that it's a patriarchal kind of family where women are meant to sort of be in the shadows and not really be part of the business, which is what James' mother was like? You know, she just put up with it all and got the prize of, you know, what that quality meant. Whereas in the Murdoch world, where the women have a reasonable amount of play in the business world, it hasn't worked out the same way. So where does Gretel sit? Is this part of their problem, that it's too it emphasises too much the sun there?
Oh, look, I think it's fact to say that the Packers have run a very patriarchal system for generations. It goes back, you know, right back to the start. And, you know, women inside the Packer group have always been secondary, if that's the right term, on a business front. And I think for Gretel, to her great credit, she did work in the business for a couple of the different divisions. And in fact, when OneTel happened, her father sort of brought her into the business because he was worried that James wasn't going to be able to cut it. I think, and I don't know Gretel at all, again, that was another slight regret of the book. You know, she didn't want to meet face to face, and I totally respect that. But she did. She was kind enough to give me some quotes on email, and I did meet her advisor face-to-face and had a long chat to him. But she's just a deeply, deeply private person, which I respect. And she's tried to keep it that way throughout her whole life. And I think for her, when, you know, the stories came out about this big fight that they had, she found that very difficult. I think she was very upset about it because, she's always lived her life, you know, in a deeply private way. Philanthropy is a huge thing to her, and James says, to her great credit, in one of his comments, you know, that she heads the philanthropic group of the Packer family, as with his mother. But I think that's the other amazing thing about this process, you know, for all the bad things that went on. And I'd be interested to hear what James and Grade will say about this, but the book almost helped them come back together because it forced them to talk to each other. Because I was trying to get on to her and she was speaking to him, and I saw before my eyes this sort of healing happen. And James says in the book, you know, there was a couple of other people involved, including his mother, including David Gonskin and Matthew Grounds from UBS. They all helped sort of bring them together, but it happened very fast. And I'm glad that if the book did play a part in that, I'm so glad to hear it.
This final question, James Packer said that, told you that he's not going to read the book, but why is he reading the extract?
There's a very simple answer to that, and James wouldn't mind me saying it, that James cannot help himself. He reads every piece of media about himself voraciously.
Well, then he'll read the book.
There's a difference between reading a newspaper and reading a book. And it's... He can't help himself. And that's been the problem over the past month, is that he has seen all these stories that have been, you know, beaten up, out of context. That's why I do hope that he does read the book one day, because I think he'll see what I've tried to achieve in the narrative, not in the things that are beaten up and taken out of context.
Hammond, many thanks.
Thank you.
We've got copies of The Prize of Fortune here tonight, and I'm sure the author will be happy to sell them. This is a very special book because it's a book that James Packer won't read, so you know more about it. You know more about it than the subject will, so there you go. Look, that was a great presentation tonight. It's a very interesting format of the way you've done this biography. It's unusual, but I think the reason why so many people are talking about it is because it's an unusual approach that's obviously worked. So congratulations on that. Biographies aren't easy to write, and you took a very complex subject and did extremely well with it. So I'm sure there'll be other projects you'll do, but for today, congratulations and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.